It's time, folks. I'm going to get started as people continue to join in. We have four sessions left in the class. It's the end game here. We have today's class, two classes next week, and Monday the following week. The project is due the Monday the following week. And as I've been promising, I'll send you a complete to-do list tomorrow. And don't be intimidated by the length of the list. It's really, and I want to be as comprehensive as I can so you know what's involved. You're actually, most of you are two-thirds, maybe even three-quarters, maybe all the way through the list. This will just wrap up the loose ends for some of you. And for some of you, it might mean, oh my God, I haven't even started. Let's get started. So it'll be enough for anybody, no matter where you are in the project. So that should be coming tomorrow to you. And one of the things I'm going to ask you to do, and I would really, really, really appreciate it if you did, is as you get the numbers for your company, your intrinsic value, your price per share, and I want you to put this off probably till next week, you know, your value per share, price per share, and your recommendation. I want you to go into that Google Shared spreadsheet, and that too will be linked in this to-do list. Remember that master sheet where I'd asked you for information about a company? If you can enter these numbers for your company, it'll help me for the last session. Because in the last session, what I plan to do is actually take your results and feed them back to you. I'd like you to see what percentage of the people in this class found their company to be undervalued, what percentage overvalued, how many had buy recommendations, how many had sell. And to give perspective, I'm going to show you what it looked like spring of 2020, spring of 2019, spring of all the way back to spring of 1999. So you can see how this has played out. Maybe it's a great predictive mechanism as to what the market will do in the future. Maybe not. But to do that, I need your numbers. So as you get your numbers done, but that's way down. So you get the project done, get the numbers done, feed me the numbers through that Google Shared spreadsheet. Are there any questions before we start? Because I'm going to start today by building on what we were talking about last session. Remember, we talked about oil companies with developed and undeveloped reserves. And I said your developed reserves you can treat with a traditional discounted cash flow valuation. You've got cash flows, you've got a discount rate, you come up with the present value. Your undeveloped reserves have optionality. Why? Because oil prices change, you can alter the way you treat those reserves. Put simply, if oil prices double, you might develop far more of those reserves and get more oil out than if oil prices have. And let's see how this will play out in investing. Let's assume you're looking at two companies. And for purposes of comparison, let's assume the two companies have the same market cap right now. This is not true, but let's say one is Royal Dutch and the other is Petrobras. They have the same market cap. But it turns out that Royal Dutch has far more developed reserves and far less in undeveloped reserves. So the proportion of the value that each company gets from developed and undeveloped reserves is different. Petrobras gets more of its value from undeveloped reserves. Royal Dutch has more of its value from developed reserves. So they have the same market cap. Let's assume tomorrow you woke up to a crisis in the Middle East. And that's not that outlandish. There's always a crisis in the Middle East. And oil prices jump from $60 to $100 a barrel. What's going to happen to the values of Royal Dutch and Petrobras? As oil prices go up, oil company stock price. So you'd expect both companies' market caps to go up, right? Let's say the day after the crisis passes, it was a rumor, it was a tweet and turned out to be not true. Oil prices back to $60 a barrel. In other words, you're back to where you started, right? Will your market caps for the two companies revert back to the old market cap? You see my question? Oil price went from 60 to 100 back to 60. So it looks like nothing has changed. Will the market caps of both companies revert back to the market cap, or will one company potentially have a higher value after this incident than the other company? If you think purely in DCF stand from a DCF standpoint, nothing has changed, right? Both companies should go back to the same value. But where does Petrobras get the bulk of its value? From undeveloped reserves, which are an option, right? So even though oil prices are back to where they were, what was it that you learned over these 2 days that might now affect the way you value those undeveloped reserves? David, what might happen? What does your intuition tell you?
That the volatility has gone up.
And Petrobras will benefit at the expense of Royal Dutch because more of its value comes from undeveloped reserves. When you look at natural resource companies, it is true the level of the price affects the value of the companies, but the volatility in that price matters just as much. So in fact, the last year, if you ask me what it's done for oil companies, it's a strange thing, but that drop that you saw in March of 2020 to $25 a barrel might actually help some companies because now oil prices are back to where they were before the crisis, but the implied volatility that people see in future oil prices might have gone up. So that's the insight you get from options. In fact, David is working on a natural resource company and you know, he was trying to apply the option pricing to his company. And the problem he was running into was the inputs you need for option pricing are often not made available to you because you have to know what the undeveloped reserves are, what the cost of developing the reserves are, what the remaining life is. And there are very few companies that give you full details. In fact, even oil companies that report undeveloped reserves report only viable undeveloped reserves, which in option terminology is in the money options, right? Basically, they ignore out of the money options, which also means that if you're trying to do this on a real oil company, you would very quickly run into data problems. You're saying, why are we then doing it? Because it still gives you insight about what drives the values of these companies. With David, I said the way this will play out is if your discounted cash flow value is very close to the price, even if you haven't valued the option, you know it's icing on the cake. It's something that's going to make the value higher. It might induce you to go buy those shares, even though today it looks pretty close to fairly valued. And that's a general point I would make about real options, even if you never apply Black-Scholes to a company. Just the knowing that there's an option embedded can change the way you approach investing in that company. Any questions on? So let's go back to where we were. No, we were starting to talk about, we finished on the option to expand. And I think, you know, as a very simple, you know, the option to expand basically means you're doing something, even though right now it might not make sense. You're assuming that at some point in time in the future, doing this can give you a chance to do other things, which is useful. Again, from the inside, it gives you as to why you might pay for a platform with lots of users who are very intense users. So it's the intent. Roblox, for instance, right now is in the news, a company that has built a gaming platform where, very interesting company. And one of the questions with Roblox is, what's that platform worth? Right now, it might not be generating profits, but what is that platform worth? It is an option. And by bringing in the option perspective, maybe that'll affect whether you buy shares in the company or not. Which brings me to the third and final option, the option to abandon. The option to abandon, put very simply, is the option you have to walk away from your mistakes. And as I said, both in personal life and in business, this is a nice option to have. Because when you walk away from your mistakes, you cut your losses. It is the only real option we're going to talk about that is a put option. Because here's how you think about an option to abandon. You abandon only if the value of your cash flows drops below whatever you get from abandoning. So if you can abandon a factory for 100 million, you will abandon the factory only if the present value of the cash flows from abandoning are less than 100 million. If the value of the cash flows are greater than 100 million, then like any other option, you're going to write off the option and what you pay for that option to abandon is essentially going to become the price of the option. So let's take a very simple example. Let's assume that you are the CEO of Lear Aircraft. Lear, as you know, makes these small, you know, commute, not even commuter, but basically, you know, executive jets and private jets. They would think 8 people, 12 people. And let's say I'm Airbus, I make big aircraft. And Lear is interested in producing a commercial aircraft, something that'll carry 40 to 50 passengers. It's never done this before. It's given up that market to Bombardier and Embraer, but Lear is interested in entering the market. So you approach me and you want me to be a joint venture partner. So I'm Airbus. I work through the cash flows. It turns out that I have to invest a half a billion for that 50% of the joint venture. And based on my assessment of the cash flows today, the net present, the present value of the cash flows I will get from this joint venture are only 480 million. So think about it. I have to invest a half a billion. I get back 480 million. That's a net present value of minus 20 million. So look at the numbers there. No, I'm not interested. But as Lear, you're very, very interested in making me your joint venture partner. So you come to me with an additional proposal. You say, look, If you're willing to be a joint venture partner and invest $500 million, and any time over the next 5 years you change your mind, I will buy your 50% stake for $400 million. Remember, you paid $500 million. I'm giving you a floor on your loss. I'm saying, look, you cannot lose more than $100 million because you can walk away. I've given you the option to walk away. Now, clearly, you're not going to walk away today because today the present value of the cash flows is $480 million. $400 million is lower than that. Today you'd stay in, but what if something catastrophic happens next year and you realize there's no market? You would then exercise the option and essentially collect $400 million. Let's see whether this might alter your decision, because I've effectively given Airbus the option to abandon. To value the option, here's the additional information. I've done a simulation of the cash flows using Monte Carlo, and I've come up with a variance in the present value of 0.16. So the $480 million could be very different. The project has a life of 30 years. So to value this put option, here are the inputs. The S is the present value of the cash flows today from abandoning, and that's going to be $480 million. The strike price is $400 million. Remember, this is a put option. So this is an out-of-the-money option. I have 5 years to exercise the option, and the variance is 0.16. So things could change. And every year that I wait, remember, it's a finite life project. I'm losing some cash flows. A 30-year project becomes 29, then 28 and 27. So the cost to delay, 0.033. That's what the only place where the project life enters in, because every year that I wait, the project has fewer years of cash flows left. Riskless rate is 6%. If I plug in those numbers into a Black-Scholes model for the value of a put, the value that I get for the put is 73.23 million. See, what does that tell me? If you're Airbus, remember the original net present value was minus 20 million? I've now given you an option to walk away, and that option to walk away is worth 73 million. You add the two numbers together, it's made this bad project into a good project. Why? Because I've given you the option or an escape hatch to leave the project if it turns out to be a terrible project. Again, you might never, ever apply option pricing to value an abandonment option, but it gives you insight into how you should approach big long-term projects. Having the option to abandon a project like that is valuable. And the longer the term of the project and the more you've invested, the more valuable it becomes if you built an escape hatch. The reason I say that is a lot of companies, it's seen as an admission of weakness when you take a long-term big project to look for escape hatches, because don't you really believe this project? Why would you want to do that? This has nothing to do with believing in your project. This is giving yourself the flexibility to be able to walk away from mistakes you've made in the on this project. And that capacity to be able to walk away from the mistakes can potentially make it more likely for you to be able to go out and take the project. So option to delay, option to expand, option to abandon. Any questions on the option to abandon? So this is actually an argument that it's better to have short-term projects than long-term projects. It's an argument for having more cost flexibility. Every argument about flexibility is really an options argument, because you're saying, I need the capacity to do this. And by doing that, you essentially make it more likely that you'll take the investment. Now, building on the theme of flexibility, I'm going to go back to something that we talked about in the context of corporate finance, where using option pricing can give you some insight to explain why companies do what they do. So the most direct application of option pricing in capital structure is when you issue convertible securities, right? Because there is actually an option, a conversion option in a convertible bond or a convertible preferred. I'm not interested in talking about those options. That's for a fixed income class. I'm actually going to talk about option pricing in the context of an optimal debt ratio. Kushal, you're in the corporate finance class as well, so maybe you can help me on this. Do you remember what the optimal debt ratio for your company is?
It's close to 30%.
And what is its existing debt ratio?
A little bit higher. I think they're high 30s.
Okay, that's not going to work for me. So I need somebody with an underlevered company, right? Because if you have an optimal debt ratio of 30% and your actual debt ratio is 10%, a lot of technology firms, for instance, you take Google, their optimal debt ratio is way above where they should be. And you push them, why aren't you borrowing more money? Their response is, because I want to maintain financial flexibility. Sounds good, right? Who wants to argue against financial flexibility? But I remember when I first ran into this brick wall 30 or 40, 35 years ago, when I'd do an optimal debt ratio for a company, I'd present to the CFO, I'd show that he was significantly underlevered. He said, no, I'm not willing to borrow money because I want to maintain financial flexibility. And the first three or four times, I just let it go. And the fifth time that word came up, I said, flexibility to do what? What are you planning to do with this? And he made a case. He said, look, if a great project comes along or there's an acquisition we want to do, having excess debt capacity is going to allow me to do that acquisition. And the subtext I was, if I go to my optimal and that project comes along, I won't be able to take it. So I said, that's interesting. You're maintaining financial flexibility because you want the option to take projects that you otherwise couldn't have taken. So I try to draw this as an option, because remember, to make this an option, you got to draw the payoff diagram. It's a messy, messy payoff diagram. I'll admit that up front. So let's assume that there is a certain amount of reinvestment you can do as a company with your normal access to financing, the capital that you borrow from. So let's make that the strike price. What we're talking about is an unexpected project, a project that takes up more of your requirements than you have. If that happens, what you're arguing is you could use your excess debt capacity to take those projects. So normally you can fund about $100 million worth of projects as a company. You've set aside enough money to cover that, but you have $1 billion once in a lifetime project come along. Having excess debt capacity allows you to take that project. That's a financial flexibility argument. And of course, the value created by that project is the net present value of that project. This is a very simple framework for assessing whether the financial flexibility argument holds up. If you have big projects that are unexpected, that earn significant excess returns, that you can use the excess debt capacity to take, I can understand why companies may choose to be underlevered. Let's take that apart. Let me take you back. I think this was my 1997 optimal debt ratio for Disney. At that time, Disney's actual debt ratio was 18%. Their optimal debt ratio was 40%. They were significantly underlevered. So by moving from their actual debt ratio to their optimal, their cost of capital dropped by about 58 basis points. So by choosing to stay underlevered, they have a cost of capital that's higher. So I talked to Disney CFO and said, look, you can get to an 11.64% debt ratio, cost of capital if you move to your optimal. And he says, no, I can't do that because I need the excess debt capacity in case a great project comes along. Let's assess how much that financial flexibility is worth. If it's worth more than 58 basis points, which is what he will gain by moving to the optimal right now, then the CFO is a good case. Maybe he should move to the optimal. So I know this is going to be tricky, but I'm going to try to value financial flexibility to Disney. I'm going to have to make a bunch of assumptions along the way that if you're an option purist, you might not like. Because I need S, K, R, all of the inputs for Black-Scholes model. The S in this model is what I typically require as a reinvestment. So I computed what Disney reinvests every year as a percentage of value. So it's net capex plus change in working capital every year as a percentage of value. It's been about 5.3%. The variance is how much that number has shifted around. And that variance is pretty high for Disney because they did a big acquisition in 97. So that pushed up their reinvestment rate. So in a typical year, Disney needs to reinvest about 5.3% of its value, but there's a lot of uncertainty about it. It could be as high as 12 in some years and as low as 2 in others. They can typically raise about 4.8% of that 5.3% from normal access to capital, you know, the usual bank loans, the bond markets. And I'm going to try to value the flexibility over a single year because I want to see whether it's greater or lower than my 0.58%. which I'm giving up by being underlevered. So if I plug the numbers in, here's what I get. I get a value for the option of 1.61%, but I'm not quite done. That is the value of what I can take because I've preserved that excess debt capacity. But to see how much true value it creates, I look at what that project will earn over and above the cost of capital. And if I look at Disney's history, at least in 1997, they're earning about 6.47% more than the cost of capital. So let's set up the trade-off here. They're underlevered. By being underlevered, they're giving up 58 basis points a year because their cost of capital is 12.22%. But by being underlevered, they're able to take projects that earn 6.47% more than the cost of capital. And that is creating 0.85% of value every year. At least in the case of Disney, when they say, look, we can't go to the optimal because our financial flexibility is worth more than what we will gain, they're on fair ground because 85 basis points exceeds 58 basis points. The value of financial flexibility comes from your capacity to take projects you otherwise couldn't have taken. Now, my suggestion is you don't actually try this on a real company. It's incredibly messy. It took me almost 2 days to do this at Disney. You're saying, so why did you bother? Because the insights you get by viewing financial flexibility as an option are really what I want you to take out of this discussion. Because take a look at what drives the value of the option. The first is, I'm assuming that if you don't have the excess debt capacity, you won't be able to take these projects, right? But as long as you have access to capital markets, you can raise fresh capital. Why should that be a constraint? The greater the access you have to capital markets, the less you should value financial flexibility. Let me repeat that again. The more access you have to capital markets, the less you need to kind of keep this excess debt capacity, because you really want to raise money, you could go out and raise the money. And here are the implications that follow. Small publicly traded companies should be more likely to be underlevered than large publicly traded companies. Why? Because small publicly traded companies value financial flexibility more. Emerging market companies should be more underlevered than developed market companies. Why? Because in emerging markets, access to capital can be shut off much more quickly by a crisis. Private companies should value financial flexibility more than public companies. Why? Because private companies have a much tougher time raising capital. Now, will companies actually do this? I don't know. But from an option perspective, from a financial flexibility standpoint, you can see why financial flexibility will matter more for some companies than others. And anytime you have a market crisis where everybody sees capital cut off, in the following years, you should see people value financial flexibility more. In fact, if you are a private company in an emerging market, not only will you have a very low debt ratio, you might actually go further. Because remember, when you accumulate cash and you have a net debt ratio that's negative, what are you doing? You're setting aside money for future investment needs. And the argument is an options argument. The second, if you look at the value of the option, it's driven by how unpredictable your reinvestment needs are. In other words, if you know exactly what your reinvestment needs are for the next 20 years, you don't need financial flexibility. You can set aside the money right now. So the more uncertain you feel about your future reinvestment needs, the more you should value financial flexibility. So if you're an infrastructure company that's building a toll road, you should value financial flexibility a lot less than if you're a technology company. And here's why. You're an infrastructure company building a toll road. You do need to reinvest a lot of money, but you have a pretty good predictable number. This is how much I need to reinvest next year, 3 years out, 4 years out. If you're a technology company and the business is changing under you, I would expect you to hold back a lot more. So I think it does make sense when you look at the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles, that they're underlevered because they are in businesses that are more unpredictable. You don't know what next year will bring, what 2 years from now will bring. They will be more likely to be underlevered than companies and businesses which are more predictable. And finally, the value of financial flexibility as an option doesn't come from the value of being able to take projects. It comes from the value of being able to take projects that have positive net present values. What does that mean? You earn more than your cost of capital. If you're in a business where you have trouble making your cost of capital on a year-by-year basis, don't even talk to me about financial flexibility. Because what's the flexibility for? If your projects are all bad projects, why would I want you to hold back on debt capacity? So when you know Kohl's, and Kohl's right now is being targeted by private equity investors, and you are underlevered and you say, look, I'm holding that back for future projects. I'm going to say, what future projects? You have trouble making your cost of capital, give the money back. So in businesses where you earn well above the cost of capital, financial flexibility is worth more than in businesses where you barely make your cost of capital. So take any company, put it through this framework, and you can please get a sense of why is my company continuing to borrow so little money? The answer might lie in that options argument. Which brings me to my final application of option pricing. I'm going to argue that when you buy equity in a publicly traded company, that equity can take on the characteristics of a call option. And let me explain why. Equity is a residual claim. Then what does that mean? You get whatever's left over after everybody else has been paid. So debt holders have to be paid capital expenditure. And if the firm is liquidated, everybody else gets first claim of the cash flows before you get whatever's left over. So first, equity gets whatever's left over after everybody else has been paid. The second is that equity in a publicly traded company has limited liability. You know what that means, right? If you pay $50 for a stock and things go really bad and the stock goes to 40 and 30 and 20 and 10 and finally it's zero, it can't go below zero. Why? Because if the value of the assets falls below the outstanding debt, you just walk away. And that's why when you talk about private businesses, this might not be true, but with public companies, equity has limited liability. Residual claim plus limited liability creates an option. And to see why, let's set up a very simple payoff diagram. You're the equity investor in a company. The company has debt outstanding. Let's think through what happens when you liquidate the company. You get a value for your liquidated assets, right? If the value of the liquidated assets exceeds the face value of the debt, you get to keep the difference. So if you have $1 billion in debt and you liquidate the company for $1.5 billion, you get to keep the $500 million that's left over. So the value of the company exceeds the face value of the debt, you get the difference. The value of the firm is less than the face value of the debt. All you lose is what you originally paid for the stock. I can't come after your personal assets, your cars, your investment portfolios. So what you originally paid for the stock becomes the equivalent of the price of the option. I know it sounds incredibly abstract, so let's take a very simplistic example. And I'm actually going to milk this example to get every conceivable implication I can for corporate finance and valuation. So let's play some roles. You guys are going to be equity investors in a company, and I'm going to be the lender of the company. We're going to see how this game plays out as things change. So the company both of us have invested in is currently valued at $100 million. But there's a lot of uncertainty about the future value. The standard deviation of value is 40%. So it could go up to 160, 50, so it can move around. So 100 million is the current value. I'm the lender. I've lent to you on a very specific type of loan. It's a 10-year zero coupon bond with an $80 million face value. And at the end of 10 years, you've got to pay me the $100 million. You're going to see in a few minutes why I had to make this a zero coupon bond, but that's what your loan looks like. So the value of $100 million, you've got one bond outstanding, 10 years to maturity, $80 million face value. 10-year bond rate right now is 10%. I'm going to argue that with this minimalist information, I haven't given you betas, ratings, cost of debt, cash flows, nothing. With this minimalist information, you should be able to tell me how much the equity in this company is worth, as well as what the fair market interest rate on the debt should be. Okay, let's try this. And to do this, I'm actually going to think of the equity in this company as a call option. So remember, you're the equity investors. Let's see how your call option plays out. The value of the underlying asset here is the value of the firm that you own equity in, $100 million. So that becomes the S in the model. If you decide to exercise this option, you know what you're doing? You're liquidating the company. If you liquidate the company, what do you have to do? You have to pay the $80 million that you owe me. That becomes the strike price. So $100 million is S, the value of the firm. K becomes the $80 million that you owe me as face value of debt, the strike price. You get to play this game for 9 years and 364 days. Because for the next 9 years and 364 days, I as the lender have zero power to force you to do anything. And now you see why I made it a nice zero coupon bond, right? Because there's no cash flow claim every year. So you get to run the firm for the next 10 years and do whatever you want. So that becomes the life of the option. So S is 100, K is 80, T is 10. The risk-free rate was 10%. And because you're uncertain about the value, that 0.4 standard deviation becomes 0.4 squared. That's a variance of 0.16. So I've got S, K, R, T, sigma. let's try this and see what we get in the Black-Scholes model. So basically I plug it in, I get D1, D2, N of D1, and N of D2. You remember what I described N of D2 as? I said it's a probability, a risk neutral probability that S will be greater than K. So Aaron, help me out here. What's S? Go back to the previous page. What's S?
S is 100 million, the value of
the firm. That's the value of the firm. And K is what I owe in my debt. So there's a 63% chance that the value of my firm, so 63% is N of D2. There's a 63% chance the value of my firm is going to be greater than my outstanding debt. Which means there's a 37% chance of what? What happens when the value of my firm is less than the, what would a lawyer call this firm if the value of the firm is less than the outstanding debt? I think I'd be technically bankrupt, right? Because I don't have enough money to cover my debt. There's a 37% chance the company will go bankrupt. There's an outfit in on the West Coast called KMV. It's been around a long time. And here's their business. If you're a bank, you can go to them with your loan portfolio and KMV will assess the probability of default on your portfolio. And people say, well, what's the big deal? So you can go to them with a $1 billion portfolio and this is a 21% chance of default in this portfolio, which has huge consequences for you, right? Because it affects how much you value that portfolio. You're saying, how did they come up with the 21%? They used the kind of a more sophisticated version of a Black-Scholes model. They take the N of D2 from that model, just like I did here. So the N of D2 is 79%. They say, well, 100% minus 79% is 21%. There's a 21% chance that the company will not make it or this portfolio will default. So there's a 37% chance that this company could be bankrupt. But notwithstanding that, if I value, put it into the model, I get a value of 75.94 for the call. You say, what does that even tell me? The equity, remember you guys own the equity in the company? The equity in this company viewed as a call option is worth $75.94 million. But if the total value of the firm is 100 million, that must mean the debt is worth 24.06, 100 million minus the 75.94. Remember, it's a zero coupon bond, 80 million in 10 years. The value today is 24.06. I can solve for the interest rate on the bond. It's 12.77%. With the minimalist information, I've been able to tell you how much the equity in this company is worth and what a fair market interest rate on the loan would be. There's actually a research paper, I don't know whether it ever got published, about 20 years ago that I was asked to review. You know how we usually estimate interest rates for companies? We use a rating and we assume Moody's and S&P are right. We do a default spread. This paper said these ratings agencies don't know what they're doing. What we're going to do instead is use an option pricing model, just like this one, to back out what the fair market interest rate should be for a company. And at least in that paper, they seem to show that this approach gave a better estimate of what a fair cost of debt would be for a company than using a rating for a company. But we're thinking about equity here, not as a collection of cash flows, but as an option to run and liquidate a company. It's a liquidation option. Now, one of the nice things about setting up such a simplistic example is now I can ask what if questions. So let's suppose that you accept my analysis. You pay $75.94 million to the equity. You're now the proud owner of the equity in this company. And you wake up to some really bad news. So tomorrow you wake up and the headline of the Wall Street Journal says that there's been a catastrophic event at this company where half the company has disappeared. Don't ask me how. Maybe they have two factories, one in Florida, one in California. Take your pick, earthquake, hurricane. One of these factories has disappeared and you're not insured. So what happens to the value of the company? Drops from 100 million to 50 million. Unless you have a very perverse definition of good news, this is not good news, right? So I have a very simple mechanical question. Before this happened, the value of your equity was 75.94 million. Now I wiped out 50 million of your firm. What will the value of equity be after? And I'll give you the three choices. It'll drop to 25.94. That's a 75.94 minus 50. It'll be worth nothing. because your accountant looked at this, your books, and said your book value of equity turned not negative. Or maybe it'll be worth more than 25.94 million. That kind of covers the spectrum. Is it worth less than 25.94, 25.94, or more than 25.94? Jesse, you want to try? What do you think the equity is going to be worth after this event? Clearly, it's going to go down. The question is, will it drop by 50 million, less than 50 million, or more than 50 million?
I mean, I would think it would drop by more than 50 million. The equity probably still worth something as an option, but I mean, they're underwater at this point.
Do I have a second on that one? Sean, what do you think? Less than 50 million, more than 50 million?
I was thinking A here.
Of 50 million. So we've got second one. So you got just the 50 million, because that's what we're taught, right? Net present value, wipe out 50 million. It comes out of your equity. Hakan, you want to finish the spectrum and tell me what do you give? I'll put the third answer in your court. I'll say, so we've got more than 50 million, 50 million, less than 50 million. Let's try it out, right? Best way to do this is actually put it in the model. Let's think about it. Then remember, you still have 10 years left, 9 years and 364 days, but close enough to 10 years. The only thing that has changed is the S. The S, which used to be 100 million, has now become 50 million. You still owe the 80 million. It's still a 10-year bond. It still has the same standard deviation, because remember, the standard deviation is a percentage value. You still have one out of the two factories. And you still have roughly the same risk constraint. If I plug in those numbers, the value that I get for the call option is 30.44 million. The value of the equity dropped by 45.5 million. It dropped by less than 50 million. But you're saying, well, then who else is bearing? Remember, the total loss is 50 million. Somebody's bearing the loss, right? If I'm bearing only 45.5 million as the equity investor, guess who the other player who's bearing the rest of the loss is? The lender, whose debt was due worth 24.06, will now find it worth only 19.56. I'm such a sharer as an equity investor. A $50 million loss, I come on in, you can bear 4.5 million. What's my first reaction? Lender, no, thank you. But there's no choice here. The company has become riskier. You have the same coupons, but the value of your debt drops. Your equity will drop by 45.5 million. But let's complete the story. Ariana, what was the probability of bankruptcy before this happened? Do you remember? Let's go back a couple of pages. It was
37%.
37%, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what's the probability of bankruptcy after this has happened?
The probability is 59%.
59%. No surprise here, right? Half the company disappears. I still owe the same amount of money. The probability of bankruptcy went up from 37% to 59%. So let's sum up. You have a drop in value of half of the company's gone away. The equity is worth less. The debt is worth less. The probability of bankruptcy has gone up. But the game continues. You know what I mean by the game continues? Once I started doing this, I couldn't stop myself. I dropped the value of the firm from 50 to 40, 40 to 30, 30 to 20. You know what I wanted to find out? When does equity become worthless? I still have the $80 million loan out there. If I keep dropping the value, at some point the equity's got to be worth nothing, right? And you know what? When I did that, I couldn't make the equity go away. It's an incredibly stubborn instrument. I dropped the value of the firm to 5 million. They owe 80 million. You're saying this company is a basket case. I agree, but the equity still hung in there. So Sergio, I have a question, an intuitive question. Clearly the company is becoming a basket case and the value becomes 10 million. What's keeping the equity afloat here? Why am I still willing to pay for these shares, even though every financial of the company is going to say this is a disaster?
I'm having a tough time trying to follow because of just the claims on the assets and the debt sitting higher in the capital structure. So like intuitively, it's worthless.
But the claim itself, by making it a zero coupon bond that's due 10 years from now, what have I given you? I've given you time, right?
Yeah.
It's time. Time is your ally here. Now, you know that most of the time when you buy, this is like buying a deep, deep, deep out of the money option. Most of the time, what's it worth? Absolutely nothing. But if something good happens and you have 10 years for it to happen, who knows? The Sultan of Brunei might say, you know what? This looks like a great company, and pay 10 times what it's worth. No, that might, It's basically time and hope that are keeping equity afloat. And the next time you see publicly traded shares in a company that everybody looks at and says, that's a basket case company. It's losing money. It's got a huge amount of debt. Why would you buy the shares? You're not buying it for the cash flows. You're not buying it for the dividends. You're buying it for the same reasons. You buy deep out of the money options. I still remember in 1993, Continental Airlines, at that time was a publicly traded stock, was on the verge of disaster. The shares were trading at $1 per share. Everybody had given up on the company. It was losing money, debt. Everybody's convinced it's going to go bankrupt. If you'd bought Continental Airlines at $1 per share, a year later, the stock was trading at $53 per share. Why? Because the company managed to find a way out. And that's what you're doing it for. 9 times out of 10, maybe even 99 times out of 100, you will lose money. But the time you make money, these are not just 10 baggers. There'll be 50 baggers, 100 baggers, because you essentially got an out of the money option. When I did this, it kind of redefined in my mind what bankruptcy really means, because at a very because we have all of these legal definitions of bankruptcy. In fact, I learned more about bankruptcy from my daughter, who's now 26, when she was 3 years old. It was a summer, it was a very long summer. I remember I would play Monopoly with my two older boys. And my three-year-old daughter would insist on joining in. She was very persistent. So finally, I gave in and said, okay, Kendra, you can play. And after about 2 or 3 games, I had to ban her from playing because she acted like a one-person Enron. She would take $200 without passing go. She would put hotels on properties that didn't belong to her. She'd ask you to pay rent when, you know, didn't even was close to the property. So finally, I said, Kendra, you can't play the game anymore. Tiny person, terrible temper. She starts walking around saying, you're bankrupt, you're bankrupt, you're bankrupt. I'm very impressed that a three-year-old is using the word bankrupt. So I said, Kendra, what does bankrupt mean? Expecting an answer like the value of your assets is less than the value of your outstanding liabilities. She said, bankrupt means you don't get to play the game anymore. Now, it's a perfect definition of bankruptcy, because as long as you get to play the game, you are not really bankrupt. And that's what this equity is doing, saying, I'm still in the game. I have 10 years to play the game. I know it looks hopeless, but as long as I have those 10 years, my equity is going to stay afloat. And that is the insight we're actually going to use to value some of your companies. Some of you have picked deeply distressed companies. And in your DCF, you know what you found? Something not surprising. The value of the assets is less than the value of the debt. The value of the equity looks negative. So what do? We're going to use this insight that sometimes you're not buying equity in companies for the cash flows. You're buying it for the optionality. David.
Yeah, just a quick question. When you were reducing the value for the factory and other things like that, why doesn't the variance climb the way it did in our Petrobras case?
Well, in the Petrobras case, the variance climbed because something external was affecting the macro variable. So for 100, here, think of standard deviation. So let's say I have 10 factories. In each one, I have expected cash flows of a standard deviation. Taking away 5 out of the 10 doesn't affect my percentage standard deviation because it's still on. So my expected cash flow is below, but the standard deviation is around the number. I'll tell you what could have made this, and this is going to be my next part. If one of my factories were in a very risky business and the other one was in a safe business, it'll depend which half I lose, right? If I lose the risky business, my standard deviation could actually go down afterwards. So that's going to be the next phase, is what if the standard deviation is affected by the choices you make? So let me use the same abstract example. I know it's very simplistic to kind of look at the conflict between debt and equity. Remember, in corporate finance, we talked about what's good for equity investors and what's good for lenders doesn't often converge. And that leads to all kinds of potential agency problems, covenants, all kinds of costs. So let's assume that you're the equity investors in the firm that I just described. So let's take it pre-catastrophe. Remember, the $75.94 million was the value of the equity, $24.06 million was the value of the debt, and the value of the firm was $100 million, right? Now let's assume that I'm a project salesperson. I go around to companies selling them really bills of goods. No, but I'm a great salesperson. So I walk into your office, you're the CFO of this company, and say, do I have a project for you? You say, okay, tell me about the project. And I describe the project, and it turns out the project has a net present value of minus $2 million. You remember your corporate finance enough, right? You're getting ready to throw me out because it's a bad project. Said, no, wait, I have more stuff I can tell you about this project. Not only is it a bad project, it's a very risky project. Now, this is going from bad to worse. Not only am I trying to sell you a bad project, I'm trying to sell you a bad, risky project. We're going to do some magic here. I'm going to argue that as the equity investors in this company, you might take a very bad, risky project and come out a winner. And to see that happen, let's take this project. Let's assume that by taking this project, you know, walking in, you're going to have a net present value of minus 2 million. But let's say by taking this project, you make your company risky. You're going to increase the standard deviation. It used to be 40% to 50%. You've made your company less valuable and more risky. That's like a double whammy, right? Let's work out what your equity is going to be worth. First, the value of your firm, because you took a negative net present value project, is going to go from 100 million to 98. That's a net present value effect, minus 2 million. So your firm is worth less. Your standard deviation went from 40% to 50%. So 0.16 becomes 0.25. This is terrible, right? You violated every single corporate finance precept. You took a bad project and you made it a bad, risky project. But to show you there's no justice in the world, let's see what your equity is worth after this terrible decision. Remember, it was 75.94 million. After you take this bad, risky project, guess what happens to value? It goes from 75.94 to 77.71 million. You say, how can that happen? You know who ended up bearing the price here? The lender did. The 24.06 that I had is... So you've, in a sense, ripped me off and become better off and made the company less valuable. This is a classic agency problem. If you're a lender to a company and you don't protect yourself, this is going to happen over time. It's called risk sharing. And what it effectively means, the company takes on more and more risk because you bear the downside. They get the equity investors get the upside. And the more levered a company becomes, the more careful you got to become about not allowing it to happen. I sometimes talk to banks that lend on LBOs, but they lend it as if it's a traditional loan. They set an interest rate, they set the loan, and they go back to being passive lenders. You cannot be a passive lender in a leveraged company, because if you're a passive lender, your equity investors will take you to the cleaners. So you could actually take a negative net present value project, which is very risky, and walk out a winner as an equity investor while you're making your company less valuable. Any questions on that example? Let's do one final example with this abstract case and we'll let it go. Now, normally when you do acquisitions, you're told that if you pay a fair value for an acquisition, it's neutral. In other words, you buy a company for 100 million and you pay exactly 150 million, it's a zero net present value investment. That's true, right? And look at any capital budgeting analysis. But let me ask you a question. As an equity investor in a company, could doing a fair value acquisition potentially change your price? Nathan, what do you think? If you're an equity investor in a company, you do a fair value acquisition, is it possible that the acquisition could make you better or worse off?
I guess just thinking on the risks front, if I add more risk into the firm, even if I pay the fair value
now. In fact,
now,
let's pause right there. When you do a merger, you bring two companies together, right?
Yeah.
And they're, let's say they're in different businesses. What's the standard deviation of the combined company going to look like after the merger? Think about two asset portfolios. You're a chemical company, you buy a technology company, you combine the company, the standard deviation of the combined company is going to be lower than what you'd have got from the two companies staying alone. So by doing a merger almost instantaneously, the combined company standard deviation is going to be lower than the standalone companies. You see what I'm setting up for? Another way to rip off your lenders. How does it happen? Let's say two companies. Let's say if the two companies have, you've got the $150 million company. There are different businesses, and I capture that with a correlation of only 0.4. Two different businesses, they're not going to be correlated 0.8 or 0.9 or 1. The combined company's variance, and if this equation looks foreign, it's because you've forgotten your foundations class. That's just a two asset portfolio, weight one squared times the variance of the first asset, weight two, and then the covariance term. the variance of the combined firm is actually lower than the variance of the two individual firms. It looks like magic, but it's a classic two asset portfolio effect. So you know what's going to happen? After the merger, you're now going to own shares in a combined company that's much safer. If you're a lender to firm A and firm B, you're dancing a dance of joy after this because your debt has now magically become safer because the combined firm is now a much safer firm. This is exactly what happens in conglomerate mergers. You basically bring together companies in different business. If you're not careful, even though you might be paying fair value, over time, your equity investors will lose out to the lenders because the lenders now are lending to a safer company. So as an equity investor in the company, is there a way you can counter this effect? What could you do to essentially protect yourself from this expropriation? When you go out to buy that company, what should you use to kind of counter the effect? You should use a lot more debt, right? Push up your debt ratio because you're a safer company, because otherwise you can end up leaking value with each conglomerate deal where the equity investors lose out to the existing lenders. So all the things we're taught, take positive net present value projects, a fair value acquisition is value neutral, all kind of get shaky when you bring in this optionality into the discussion. But as I said, what I really want to use this to do is to talk about how I can use this to value some companies where I otherwise have to give up. If I had to apply this option pricing model to value a public equity in a publicly traded company, let's think of some of the challenges you're going to face. In the example, the abstract example, I gave you the value of the firm is 100 million. That's not given in a traditional valuation. I made my debt one nice zero coupon bond. What company do you ever run into that has only one nice zero coupon bond as its only debt? It's 10-year debt, 5-year debt, 3-year debt, some as coupon, some debt. I gave you the variance in the value, which is going to be difficult to get for a real company. So most people will do the abstract example, and then they'll say, you know, too difficult to apply on real companies. We're going to move on. I'm actually going to try to do this in a real company, and I'll tell you the kinds of companies where we would try this. Remember, this is a liquidation option. You're essentially liquidating the company, you're giving up your growth assets, and you're paying off your debt. If you're Microsoft, I'm not even going to waste my time doing a liquidation option. It's not going to be worth much. If you're Nike, not worth much. The kinds of companies where this approach is going to work is companies that have a lot of debt. And by a lot of debt, I'm talking about debt ratio of 60, 70, 80%. And are potentially losing money. So if you have a money-losing company that a lot of debt, and some of you might as a company you picked, then this approach is going to work. So out of the 200 people in this class, maybe 25 of you will find this useful as a way. For the rest, you know, it's not going to work. So don't force your company into it if it's not going to work. Let's talk about how, though, for that company, you're going to be able to get the inputs that make it look like my abstract example. First up, I'm going to ask you, what's the value of your firm? The nice thing is if you're doing this after your DCF value, which you've already done, you should have a value for the operating assets you got from your DCF. You can use that as your S. If you haven't done that, then you can even use a pricing, an EBITDA multiple to your existing EBITDA revenue multiple. So value the firm, you can either do a discounted cash flow valuation of the existing assets, or you can use a pricing. Or if you want to value it as a sum of the parts, a liquidation value, you could do that. So the V will then be what you get from your DCF. The variance is going to be tricky, right? Because when you did your DCF, you gave me one value. If I ask you what's the variance of that value, you're saying, I have no idea. If you did a Monte Carlo simulation on your DCF, great. Then you can use that standard deviation. But I don't think more than a couple of you tried a Monte Carlo simulation, and it's not worth the effort of building from scratch. So I'm going to let you cheat. If your company has traded stocks and bonds, you can use the standard deviations of those traded stocks and bonds to compute a variance in firm value of the company. But if you don't have that, there's a third choice. Remember how we did bottom-up betas? We said, if you're in the steel business, your beta is roughly 0.9. What if I could give you a table of standard deviations in value by business? It's actually a table on my website where I do that. And I say, you're a steel company, you can go look up the bottom-up standard deviation value, use that in the option pricing model. So let's review. You can either do a Monte Carlo simulation, a lot of work. You can take standard deviations of stocks and bonds issued by the company, which is less work, but you might not be able to get the data easily. Or you can do the variance or standard deviation of the sector that your company's in using your option pricing model. So I've got S, I've got standard deviation. Let's talk about debt. In any company, especially if it's a troubled company, you're going to have 50 different debt issues, 30 different debt issues, different maturities, different durations, different setups. I'm going to try to convert, and this is cheating, and I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to take all of the debt and try to convert it into an equivalent zero coupon bond. In other words, I'm going to take your 20 different, and say if I had 1 0 coupon, and I'm going to act like you have 1 0. I know it's cheating, but it'll make my life so much easier. So I'm going to take a weighted duration of all of your debt and make that the duration of the zero coupon bond and add up the face value and interest payments in your debt and make it what I would pay at that duration. That is going to, so by the time I'm done with this, I'm going to have something that looks like that abstract example from a more complicated company. So let me try this on a company. You've heard of the Eurotunnel, right? Eurotunnel is this hole in the ground between France and England where cash flows in but never flows out. And the reason I say that it was when it was originally built, the Eurotunnel did all these visions of how it was going to make money, and it's never made money. It's been a money loser right from day one. And this was a valuation I did very early on in early 1998. And I'll tell you why Eurotunnel met my requirements for using option pricing model. First, it was losing a ton of money. That's the first requirement. It was, so that standard got met. It had been losing money for a long time. You know how I knew? The book value of equity had turned negative. So clearly it's a money loser. That's one condition met. And it owed a ton of money. And in fact, if you looked at its debt, there was very short-term debt, $935 million, 10-year debt, 20-year debt, even longer. In sum, it owed about 8.9 billion pounds in debt, with an average duration of about 11 years. So it has really long-term debt and a lot of it. Money-losing company with a lot of debt. I'm not buying Eurotunnel for the dividends. I'm not going to get any. I'm not buying it for the cash flows because I don't like negative cash flows. I'm buying it for one reason and one reason alone, because of its optionality. So I'm going to try to value equity in Eurotunnel as an option. To value it as an option, I've got the debt, but I need to know what the value of the assets is. So here's what I did. I did a traditional discounted cash flow valuation. So think of the DCF I have, right? Revenue growth, margins, sales to cap. I put that in. The value that I got for Eurotunnel's assets with the discounted cash flow model was about 2.3 billion pounds. So this is free cash flow of the firm discounted back at the cost of capital. And I was optimistic. I assumed the margins would improve and they'd fix themselves. We're in big trouble. Do you see why? You remember what they owed? 8.9 billion. What do I think they're worth? 2.3 billion. If I stopped there and said, would you pay for the shares? You say, are you crazy? Why would I pay for these shares? This company's worth nothing. And you're right. As a going concern, the equity in this company is worth nothing. In fact, somebody would have to pay you to take the equity. But let's think of it as an option. The S in the model, and to get the option, I need to think about the uncertainty I have about the 2.3 billion. And here, I had a tough time finding an industry average because how many holes in the ground would I have as publicly traded companies? Today, I might be able to get away with infrastructure companies and toll road companies. In 97, I had none. So here, I had to actually depend on the market. And I got lucky. Both the stocks and the bonds issued by the company were traded. The standard deviation in the stock price was about 41%. The standard deviation in the bond price was 17%. The variance I want is a variance in overall value, not just in stock prices. And to compute the variance in value, I again drew on that two asset portfolio, the variance of a portfolio. And I used the fact that the correlation in the stock and the bond price at this company was about 0.5. I mean, it sounds convoluted, but this 0.0335 is the variance in firm value at Eurotunnel. Again, don't be thrown off by how low it looks. Remember, 0.0335 is 335% squared. Variance is percentage squared. 0.0335. So what's giving Eurotunnel equity its value? The fact that they have 2.4 billion value that could change. And that standard deviation captures that change. So I'm ready now. I can value Eurotunnel equity as an option. The S in the model becomes the 2.3 billion pounds that I estimated. That's from a DCF value. The K in the model is the 8.9 billion that I owe as debt. This is a deep out of the money option. Really good things have to happen for my equity to be worth something. But here's my redeeming grace. This company has a lot of really long-term debt. In fact, the duration of its debt is 10.93 years. In fact, if you can't do duration, do a weighted maturity, you're going to be close enough, 10.93 years. The variance is 0.0335 from the previous page. The riskless rate is 6%. I do D1, D2, N of D1, N of D2. Manav, what's the probability that Eurotunnel will go bankrupt? Which ND am I going to look at? N of D1 or N of D2?
D1, ND1.
No, it should be N of D2. So N of D2 is 7.5%. What does that tell me? There's a 7.5% chance that S will be greater than K. The value of the firm is going to be greater than the debt. There's a 92.5% chance of failure. So clearly, I'm not doing this unrealistically. I know that this is a disaster company. There's a 92.5% chance it will not make it. It's a deep out of the money option. But here's the magic of optionality. With all of this bad stuff going on, guess what the value that I get for the call is? It's 122 million. It's deeply distressed, but the equity is still going to trade, but it's trading for a different reason than equity in a going concern. It's not for the cash flows, it's the optionality. And one of the nice things about this particular option is every time debt comes due, which I worry about when I have an option, because debt coming due could be my day of reckoning, my option could end. The governments, the UK and the French governments, put pressure on banks to extend the loan. It's almost like having an option, the maturity keeps getting pushed out. This is the type of company where option pricing can give you a value where everything else fails. You can't price this company, you can't do a discounted value, you're valuing it as an option because that's the only reason its value is what it is. In fact, have you heard of vulture investing? Vulture investing basically is this branch of investing where you pick companies, deeply troubled companies, their equity and their debt, and you load up on those companies because you're essentially hoping to make money. Because some of those companies, with vulture investing, you don't own shares in companies, you own a bunch of out of the money options. Which means even if you're a great vulture investor, if I look at 50 investments in your portfolio, 35 will never see the light of day. But the 15 that make it will make 300, 500, 700% returns and your overall portfolio will deliver. So if you're a vulture investor, I'm going to ask you some questions about where you're going to look for your best investments. Are you going to look at companies with a lot of debt or not very much debt? You want companies with a lot of debt. That's what gives it the optionality. Long-term debt or short-term debt? You want long-term debt. And in businesses with a lot of uncertainty or very little uncertainty, you want businesses with a lot of uncertainty. You're going to load up on companies with a lot of debt in very unstable businesses. It's almost perverse, right? Because you're doing everything you're not supposed to do. But when you're investing in options, risk is your ally. You want to go with the uncertainty. You want to go with long-term debt because that's where the optionality comes from. You know, last March, almost every airline was trading as an option. Because every airline, if you looked at its financials, then there is no way I'm buying this as a going concern. And you know what? If you bought that portfolio of options, you're feeling pretty good today about what those options have done for you. So don't look down on options because they don't fit all the requirements for, you know, what's traditionally viewed as value in a company. Because it is a way of investing. It's a different way of investing. It requires a different mindset where you're not requiring every one of your investments to pay off. You're going to lose money. In fact, all of your money in some of those investments. But as long as you get those big hits on those deep out of the money options that become in the money options, you're going to come out ahead. Any questions on thinking of equity as an option? So take a look at your company. Now check to see if it's money losing. If it's not money losing, don't even try it. If it's money losing, check to see if it has a lot of debt. And use the debt to cap ratio, market terms, as a measure. My simple proxy is the debt to cap is less than 50%. There's no point even looking for an optionality. It's not distressed enough or troubled enough for the liquidation option to pay out. But if you have an 80% debt to cap ratio and you're a money losing company and you've been losing money for a while, the options argument will kick in. Don't try this on young growth companies with no debt. Liquidation option are not going to give you any significant jump in the value. David?
Yeah, sorry, can I go back to the Disney example and the flexibility?
Uh-huh.
Just a quick question to make sure I'm understanding it. On that, on slide 60, the 85 basis points and the value of flexibility and comparing that to the 58 basis points, mm-hmm. Is it right to say that value goes away if Disney doesn't do that extra project within like 15 months or something? Because
it will get lower. Let's see what drives the value. The excess returns go to zero. If I assume 0% excess returns, the value flexibility goes to zero.
Yeah.
The more uncertain I am about future projects, so Disney's project predictability gets better, the value of this option will decrease. Right. So if you feel the business is getting more stable. And finally, time is working against you. Every year that you don't do this, you lose credibility. Because after 10 years, you keep saying, well, just wait a project and nothing comes along. As an investor, I start saying, well, maybe not. So time is going to work against you. But it's not a specific clock as much as what investors think about your future projects. The longer you go without these projects, the less people trust that those projects even exist. The value flexibility is going to decrease.
Okay, thanks.
So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start on the next session, but I'm not going to get very far because I'm going to leave you with some big questions about acquisitions. Now, about 10 years ago, one of my students actually runs these seminars in New York for CEOs and CFOs of companies. And he was running a seminar for CFOs of serial acquirers. You know, serial acquirers are, these are companies that do an acquisition of the month club. So he was putting together this conference of CFOs of serial acquirers. And he said, would you be willing to talk at the conference? And I said, are you sure you've got the right guy? Because you know what I think about acquisitions. I have a very cynical view that if you want to destroy value quickly, this is the easiest way to do it. And he said, no, I want you to come and talk to them because for the rest of the day, they're going to hear from investment bankers in M&A. And what investment bankers in M&A think about acquisitions, they're the mother's milk of deal making. So they're going to hear a lot of good stuff about why they need to do acquisitions. And I want you to give the counter view. So I showed up at like 4:30 in the afternoon. They'd been listening to M&A bankers all day. And I put up my cover slide just to kind of illustrate where I was coming from. And I've preserved the title of the slide. The session was titled Acquirers Anonymous, 7 Steps to Sobriety. And the reason I say that is I firmly believe that acquisitions are an addiction. And what I mean by that is when companies start to grow with acquisitions, they get lazy because it's so much less work. There's so much more glamour. Growing internally always takes more work. It takes more effort. So if you're a CEO of a company, do an acquisition, you say, this was easy. Why would we pick projects and do this? Let's just do an acquisition a year. And like any addiction, there are people who feed that addiction, right? And you know who the drug dealers in this business are. The bankers, the consultants, everybody in this ecosystem, you too can be great here. This is great. So if you listen to bankers and consultants, you're going to be doing acquisitions from now through eternity. So what I want to do is take partly a cynical view and partly a skeptical view of acquisitions. So I'm going to set up the process. And then the next session, we're actually going to dig deeper as to what's going on. If you take an acquisition, there are two companies involved. There's the acquiring company and there's the target company, right? If I showed you what happened to stock prices of these two, and if I asked you which company would you rather be a shareholder in, it's no contest. So in this graph, for instance, the red line is what happens to target companies, and that's the day of the day zero is the day of the acquisition. Not surprisingly, the target company stock prices jump on acquisitions. And the blue line is what happens to the acquiring company. Shareholders in acquiring companies, on average, lose money around acquisitions. Not much, minus 1%, minus 2%, but if you have big acquiring companies and small target companies, what acquiring companies lose could be greater in dollar terms than what target companies get. Put simply, if you open up the Wall Street Journal and you read the news of an acquisition, you're hoping and praying that you're the target company shareholder, not the acquiring company shareholder. So acquisitions are great for target companies, shareholders. They're, on average, bad news for acquiring company shareholders. And if you ask CEOs and CFOs of companies about that, their response is, but you don't see what we see. What do we see? We saw the projections. We saw the synergy. We saw all this great stuff the banker says will come out of the deal. Shareholders are short-term. They don't see the benefits. And that's why the acquisition day, they treat us badly. So that's a testable proposition, right? If you track acquisitions 5 or 10 years after they're done, if CEOs and CFOs are right, what should you see? That on average, acquisitions make companies stronger. They make their margins go up, their returns go up, they create value. And McKinsey and KPMG have actually looked at M&A deals 5 or 10 years later, and the results they present are not pretty. McKinsey's done this multiple times. They ask two basic questions. I think they're pretty questions you'd ask about any investment. Is the return on capital and acquisitions greater than the cost of capital? A question we ask about any investment, including synergy, are the returns. And does the acquisition help the parent company, the acquiring company, become stronger relative to its peer group? In other words, by doing this acquisition, did you improve yourself? And most acquisitions fail at least one, and many fail both tests. So if you look at the long-term track record of acquisitions, it doesn't seem to work out. You know that in acquisitions, only 20% of mergers actually see tangible synergy. These are mergers motivated by synergy. If you track them 5 or 10 years in, show me the synergy, only 20% show any evidence of synergy. And here's the ultimate, I think, damning fact on acquisitions. Half of all acquisitions are reversed within 10 years of being done. In other words, you acquire a company, half of those acquisitions are reversed within 10 years. Basically, an admission by the acquiring firm saying it didn't work out. But here's the scariest thought. This has been known for almost 40 years, that acquisitions don't work, they don't create value. But they keep happening. It's not like people are learning, say, okay, we'll do fewer acquisitions. And if you think this is restricted just to US companies, think again. Until about 25 years ago, developed market companies acquired emerging market companies. But starting by 25 years ago, you started seeing emerging market companies become the acquirers. And I remember when this first started to happen in India, there was a great deal of, you know, patting yourself on the back saying, we've arrived, look, we're acquiring, you know, US companies. Tata Steel buys Cora Steel, Tata Motors buys Jaguar Land Rover. But the problem is if you track Indian companies doing acquisitions, you see the same phenomenon play out, which is if you track the share price of the Indian companies doing the acquisition 10, 12, 14 months after the deal, initially there's a bounce in the price, but that bounce fades and you end up losing money. The bottom line is there's something in this process that's making acquiring companies pay too much. It's a loser's game, no matter how you slice it, whether you look at the acquisition day, you look at the 5 years, you look at the... So if I were to summarize what I see here, it basically looks like acquiring firms are paying too much on deals. And there's something in the process that keeps them doing this even though they can see the data. There's something wrong with this process. The process is broken. This is not a question of mechanics. You can't say it's because they got the valuations wrong. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's something fundamentally broken in the acquisition process that's leading to a lot of bad decisions. And you know what? We know exactly what it is, but we don't want to do anything about it. In the US, if you want to do an acquisition, you're going to do a deal. Who's in charge of analyzing the deal? So tell me how the process works. You're an acquiring company, you see a target company, want to do an acquisition. You pick a bank, right? The bank is going to be your deal maker. And then what do? You ask the bank, does the deal make sense? It's a conflict of interest that's fundamental. We've talked about this conflict of interest. Of course, the deal is going to make sense from the banker's perspective. The deal maker cannot be the deal analyst. It's a fundamental and first rule. But in acquisitions, the deal maker is also the deal analyst. It's a very simple fix for that, right? Pay the banker for doing the deal. There's actually a transactional element here where the banker is useful. Pay someone else to tell you whether the deal makes sense. And they get paid a fixed fee no matter whether you do the deal or not. So you might call KPMG to say, does this deal make sense? There are some countries where they're moving towards this. Singapore is very actively pushing towards making this part of the required process, that the deal maker cannot be the deal analyst. The problem in the US is the deal makers and deal analysts are all investment banks. So basically, it'll be like a fairness opinion. Nobody wants to give an opinion that's going to make Goldman Sachs worse off because Goldman Sachs could be a deal analyst on the next deal you're doing. But this process needs to be fixed, because if it doesn't get fixed, what you saw in that graph will continue to play out over and over and over and over again. So we can keep presenting the results, nothing will change. So next session, what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you a pre-class set of questions. And basically, it'll take about 5 minutes to do. If you get a chance, work through those questions. Because what I did in this particular seminar that I did for those CFOs of serial acquirers is I offered them a deal, which none of them took. I said, look, I know that you guys like to do acquisitions, but I'd like to make a deal with you. I'm going to put you through a 7-question test. And if you can get 4 out of the 7 questions right, you can go back to doing the deals. But if you fail more than 3 questions, I'd like you to stop doing deals. None of them took me up on it. But I'm going to send you those 7 questions, because those 7 questions are going to go to the heart of why so many bad deals go through. So I will see you on Monday. And remember, watch your email tomorrow for the full to-do list on the rest of your project. No, and it'll be comprehensive. It'll tell you everything that needs to get done. But that's about it. Take care.